We now have both counsel present and ready for Williamson versus the City of National City. And again, your time is your total time, and you may watch the clock for keeping track of any rebuttal that you may wish to use. So with that, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. Lee Roy Stacker for the appellants. My plan is to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time, and I'll keep an eye on the clock. The district court in this case erroneously denied my client's qualified immunity summary judgment motion for two reasons. Under the factual record established by the district court, it's certainly our position that there was no Fourth Amendment violation. But even if there was, there was no clearly established law.
May I ask you a question about your alternative? As I understand it, and I'm not in any way an expert on California law, but as I understand it, the state law claim under the Bain Act does not rely on the qualified immunity prong of clearly established law. Am I right about that? So that's not part of the analysis?
That wasn't a very clear question.
If there's excessive force under the Bain Act, is that sufficient without regard to whether the law was clearly established?
Well, I will say this. For purposes of the appeal and to ensure jurisdiction over the Bain Act claim, you're right that if there's a Fourth Amendment violation, as the case is briefed, that would get rid of the Bain Act. But if there is a question about that and qualified immunity is granted on the fact that the law is not clearly established, that doesn't automatically eliminate the Bain Act claim.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. You said it more coherently than I did, but thank you.
I appreciate that.
So if we found qualified immunity, but on the Bain Act, we would actually have to find no Fourth Amendment violation. Is that right?
To eliminate the Bain Act claim, correct.
So let me ask you, why couldn't a jury reasonably find that the officer's decision to continue dragging Williamson out of the room as she was yelling in pain, rather than stopping and securing her in a more comfortable position, have constituted excessive force under these circumstances?
Could a jury concluding that was excessive force, in my opinion, would not be following the law. We're presented with a circumstance where they are in a chaotic situation, as the videos depict. They need to get her and the other protesters out of the room. None of them will leave. None of them will comply. They're employing deadweight tactics. They attempt to lift her up, and her deadweight tactics take her back down to the ground. They have to get her out of the room, and they have to get her out of the room quickly. And they chose the manner in which they did to remove her by dragging her out.
Now, when you say quickly, were people from the audience throwing things at the officer?
I don't believe they were throwing things, at least at that point. But at least my view of the videotape certainly shows a situation that was quite chaotic and could have turned into something else at any minute. I think it's important, with your question, I think it's important that just to review some Fourth Amendment principles that apply to this, the question of whether the force used was unreasonable. The court has never held that no force can be used against a passive resister.
I don't think that's her claim. I think, you know, the crime was a minor crime in the sense that it was a misdemeanor. Disturbance of a public meeting is a misdemeanor. There was no immediate threat to anyone. There was no active resisting arrest, no attempt to flee from the police. And so this is a person who's screaming in pain And you think that's okay to just ignore that and keep going, and that no jury could, as a matter of law, find that that's excessive?
Well, I think the, well, first of all, the fact that someone's screaming in pain doesn't necessarily, or screaming, I should say, doesn't necessarily indicate to the officers that someone is actually in pain. People being arrested make a lot of noise. I know that she suffered a broken shoulder after the fact, that was learned, but they have to get her out quickly, and that's what they did. They didn't drag her completely around the room. But let me say this, could there have been other ways potentially they could have taken her out of the room, hypothetically, that in retrospect would have been better? Yeah, maybe. Maybe that happens. But because there are other ways doesn't mean the way that it was done was unreasonable. Reasonableness from the standpoint of an objective officer encompasses a range of conduct. And as long as the conduct falls within the range of reasonableness, there's no violation.
But we have to take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And when you say, for example, well, she was screaming, but maybe she wasn't in pain, don't we have to take it that her screams and her claims of pain were genuine?
Well, in retrospect, they certainly were genuine. But,
well, I'm asking you a different question. I'm saying for purposes of summary judgment, which is where we are on the Bain Act claim at least, don't we have to interpret the facts in the light most favorable to her?
That is true. That is correct. But I don't think the fact that there's pain involved in a... in removing her from the room automatically equates to a Fourth Amendment violation.
It's not a matter of automatic. See, that's the problem. The question is whether there's a genuine issue of fact. The only, as a matter of law, would have to be on your side of the equation. So you're saying it doesn't automatically equate to excessive force, but that isn't the question we're asked. It's whether a jury, consistent with the law, could find excessive force in this situation.
Well, let's look at Forrester for a minute, because I think that's an apt comparison. In Forrester, where this court found the force used reasonable, protesters were removed by officers when they took their nunchucks, which the two wooden sticks connected with a cord. They wrapped them around the person's wrist and progressively made it tighter, intentionally causing pain to get them to move.
But counsel, Forrester didn't hold anything more than that the jury's verdict was consistent with the evidence, that it was a permissible verdict. It did not say that that had to be the verdict as a matter of law. I don't see how it's even particularly relevant to our situation, other than to say this person might lose in front of a jury, as did the person in Forrester. Well, but it didn't establish as a matter of law that that was not excessive.
Well, it was after a jury verdict, correct, but I think it informs on the type of force that can be used legitimately against a passive resistor.
Well, the other thing I guess that the question I have too is, it seems to me inherent to your argument is a little bit that the plaintiff's behavior caused the problem. And I think the cases that you cite in support of your argument on Williamson's relative culpability appear to involve situations where the arrestee is fleeing or actively resisting arrest. Do you have any authority for the proposition that someone passively resisting can be considered relatively culpable for injuries suffered during the arrest?
Yeah, there is no authority for that. And the reason is I don't think this court has addressed it. But on that point, I'm not sure. I don't think it really matters. I don't think it really matters whether somebody is fleeing or being dangerous and looking at their relative culpability, because there is relative culpability in the conduct that she undertook. This all literally could have been avoided had she gotten up and walked out of the room. And It was passive resistance, but there was also the fact that she just didn't get up and walk out on her own after being.
Well, counsel, you know, every excessive force case where there's an arrest involved could be avoided if the person didn't commit the crime. And that's what you're saying, because her crime was disrupting a public meeting. And if she'd gotten up and left, you're right. But I guess that doesn't really seem to be responsive to the question whether once you have committed a crime and you're being arrested, what is sufficient to go to a jury on excessiveness?
I would say this in that scenario. She was arrested after she was handcuffed and on the ground. And the fact is she could have gotten up and left at that point. I understand the court's argument. Or the court's position on that. I'm looking at my time. I'm over 10 minutes, and I could save the qualified immunity, the clearly established part for my rebuttal. But I do want to touch.
You can use your time any way you wish.
Let me just touch on that for a minute. The court's well familiar with the qualified immunity standards that the Supreme Court has laid out. The plaintiff has the burden in that respect to show a case that's sufficiently similar to put all reasonable officers on notice that the conduct was unconstitutional. The issue has to be beyond debate. All the case law cited by the plaintiff, what it does establish is that non-trivial force can't be used against a passive resistor. But the force here was not non-trivial. It wasn't tasers, it wasn't blows, it wasn't baton strikes, it wasn't a throwdown. It wasn't pepper spray. It wasn't a beanbag to the face. It was dragging her out of the room. So the question is, where is the case that would tell the reasonable officer that dragging somebody out of the room, out of a meeting room that's been arrested, is unconstitutional? Where is the case that talks about minimal or trivial force being unconstitutional? None of the cases cited by the plaintiff, certainly nothing cited by the district court, but none of the cases cited by the plaintiff establish that. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, you may do that. And we'll hear from Mr. Roystocker. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name.
You pronounced my name right, but I believe it's
Mr. Gilliland's turn. Sorry. It's Mr. Gilliland's time. You're muted still.
I said no problem, Your Honor. I've been called worse. the appellant's case is, as I understand it, their argument before the court is that there's no Fourth Amendment violation and there's no clearly established case. But it sort of skips over what my first argument was in this case, in that qualified immunity protects everybody except those that knowingly violate the law or are, I'm just looking at my notes here, clearly incompetent. And in this case, I don't even think we get to qualified immunity on, you know, I don't think we need to look at the cases and try to figure out what's going on, even though that I believe those are in my favor. You know, in this case,
Mr. Gilliland, I'm concerned if for me to buy your argument, I'm concerned over the fact that obviously passive resistance isn't completely innocuous. It's very hard to move people that are dead weight. They are it is a resistance of sort. Anyone that's tried to move someone that is dead weight knows that it's really hard, and they are increasing their likelihood of injury. So when the officers are confronted with a situation where they have people that is their resistance to be dead weight, and they have to get something cleared up, and I recall that there was a need to get people out quickly. It happened very fast. Why should someone becoming dead weight, should they be allowed to use that in their favor when it's making the officer's job so much harder?
Well, I think we've had
increasing their chance of injury. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah, and I think we've had passive resistance in this country as long as we've had civil rights cases. This is a technique. It's nonviolent. It has been advocated by some of the best civil rights activists for decades. And it's a way to make your point and for these officers to look at Ms. Williamson, who they considered was sort of the catalyst behind all this. I mean, she was clearly treated differently than all the other the people there. And so dead weight,
how,
I mean...
I mean, I've watched that video. How was she treated differently?
Well, if you look at the protesters that were removed before her, they were picked up underneath their arms, and they were using dead weight, too. And they lifted them up under their arms, not hyperextending their shoulders to any degree whatsoever. And you'll see in the video, they're drug out, but they're drug out in a respectful manner, and they're drug out in a way that does not hyperextend your shoulders and tear the labrum or rotator cuff. When it was time to get Ms. Williamson, who these defendants know were the leader of this group, they handcuffed her, and then they turned around and they drug her backwards instead of lifting her up like they did with all the other protesters. And I think it's also important, Judge Forrest, to add that there were two more protesters that were taken out after Ms. Williamson. So I hear a lot about, oh, there was chaos and nobody was throwing anything yet. Nobody threw anything ever, by the way, but it was chaos and we needed to move quickly. There was no chaos. There were more police officers in the room than there were protesters.
What in the record tells us that the officers thought or believed that your client was the leader of this event?
Well, I think it's a disputed fact. I think it's a disputed fact. That's something that we've alleged.
You can't just allege that without some sort of factual basis. So that's what I'm asking. What in the record indicates that that's the truth? Or that it possibly could be the truth?
Just your
client's assertion?
Yeah, that's right.
It's not nothing, just her opinion.
Yes, that she organized this. She was arrested the month before. And she came back and she still wanted to support this family and get the body-worn camera of their deceased loved one. And she was targeted, but that's not really here nor there, Judge Forrest. I didn't mean to sort of go on a tangent there. Regardless of the officer's intent to hurt her, what we're looking at is the way she was treated in an objective fashion. And she's being treated in such a way that was clearly different than everybody else. And again, now after she's drug out screaming, drugged by the wrists, they have two more protesters to remove. The officers went back into the room and they removed the final two protesters in a very respectful way and in a way that did not hurt them.
I want to ask you one other question because I didn't understand that was going to be your position. My question before hearing this was going to be, what would you have had the officers do different? I mean, I think speaking for my colleagues, I think we would say, you know, we understand the significance of what your client was doing here and that the law, you know, recognizes peaceful protest and that we kind of have to tread lightly in that context because that's a function of our free society. But at the same time, we can't allow activity to just shut government function down. So what were the officers supposed to do? And is your argument simply they should have taken her out like they took everyone else out? I mean, I'm not sure I agree that they treated her differently. I'll have to go watch the video again because I certainly didn't see that the first time. But is that your position, that they should have just taken her out the way they took the other people out?
Well, I think if they took her out just like they took everybody else out, I don't think we would be here. So to answer your question, yes.
The follow-up to that is we have a precedent in the Ninth Circuit that says the officers are not obligated to use the least intrusive means. They're obligated to act reasonably. So how is it that... we'll assume for purposes of my question that something was done different with Ms. Williamson. How is it that their actions were not reasonable?
What I do was in my brief, Mr. Rostatcher talked about the lack of cases to support plaintiff's position, to answer your very question, Judge Forrest. And he says that the non-trivial force doctrine is the only doctrine that plaintiffs advance, which is untrue. we advance a line of cases about causing unnecessary pain during arrest. And that's what this is. And this court is replete with decisions about causing unnecessary pain during arrest. Now, I'm not abandoning the non-trivial force doctrine. I think it's very important and I think it applies. But when you talk about, you know, what could these officers have done? We have the case of Keckley. We're pulling a kid's hands up, his handcuffed arms, pulling them up, pulled him up off the curb. A jury can find that that's excessive force. We have Mr. Wall, who was just getting an oil change, and he was thrown against the hood of the car, and his arms were cuffed, and they were lifted. We have Meredith. She was being investigated for filing false tax returns. She was thrown to the ground. Her arms were twisted, causing marks, causing her to go to the ER. And then we have Winterrod, which was pulled over for expired license tabs. And when he was taken out of the car, his arms were pulled up. I mean, it's an unnatural motion. It's an unnatural motion. And I think, respectfully, that the appellant's position lacks a little bit of common sense. Because if anybody is handcuffed and they're taken by the wrists and their arms are lifted up, everybody knows what the response is. It's ow, 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 ow. It's only done to administer pain. And so they use this technique, I'll call it, to drag her out of the room, and it is causing unnecessary pain during arrest. That's the clearly established case law in this case.
Well, let's assume that if we go look at the video and they did the same with everyone, but the difference with your client hypothetically was that maybe she behaved differently and that's why she was injured. Do you still have a claim?
I'm sorry, Judge Callahan.
Well, let's say they used the same technique to remove everyone. Let's assume.
And when you say same technique, you mean to handcuff and drag them by the wrists? Or to
lift
them
like... Well, so what was different about how they removed your client than everyone else?
Well, she was handcuffed and dragged backwards by the wrists for about 30, 40 feet on the ground. The other ones were lifted up underneath the armpits like this. They're lifted up and you can see them. Their feet are trailing, they're dragging on the ground, but they lift them up and they're carrying them out.
So why did they have to handcuff your client and they could just lift the other people?
To be fair, I think they handcuffed everybody. They handcuffed everybody, but my client was the only one they drug backwards by the handcuffed wrists.
What if your client, let's just say she'd had rotator cuff problems before, if we thought that everyone was treated basically the same, is the officer then still culpable? If someone's like more, say, an eggshell plaintiff as opposed to a stronger person?
I was just going to say, in that hypothetical, I think we would be arguing the eggshell plaintiff rule. I haven't researched it, but and I don't know how that comes out, but it's not.
Well, let me ask you, I think to follow up with Judge Callahan's hypotheticals, if they had treated your client the same way and lifted her up under her armpits, but she had some kind of, you know, horrible problem under her armpit that they wouldn't have known about, there might not be excessive force, even in your view, I take it.
Of course, everything is fact-driven, but I tend to agree with you, yeah. I mean, my case is that look how they've treated her differently. They treated her in a way that causes unnecessary pain. And so, to be honest with you, I don't know what we would be arguing if she had some sort of pre-existing, like something that ruptured in her armpit if they picked her up like that. But I also don't want, and I hope I've answered your questions adequately, I also don't want to lose sight of the fact that, the first argument in our brief is that these officers were either incompetent or knowingly violating the law. And I think that the one way that you can look at this case is looking at their police reports. Okay, I mean, there is a famous quote from the late 1800s, you know, the problem with police reports is the people that do the shooting write the reports. We have in this case both officers that drug her backwards by her wrists, both put in their police reports that for Officer Nguyen, I put my arm under Miss Williamson's left arm while holding onto Miss Williamson's upper arm area. We began to carry her out of the room. which was a few feet away, few typically meaning three. It's not true. And then Officer McGuff writes the exact same thing, just in reverse. It was me doing it, and we lifted her up by her armpits, by her upper arms. They wrote what they know they should have done. And the question is, why did they lie about it? And they lied about it because they know they shouldn't have done it this way. And instead of National City looking at the police reports and comparing it to the video and going, oh, son of a gun, it looks like it really was more than 3 feet. I don't think these officers are telling the truth. They don't withdraw these reports. They make it sort of the centerpiece of this case. And I think it's terribly dangerous to do that. And then you've got the sergeant. You know, there was such a hurry to get Ms. Williamson out of the room, but as soon as they got the other two protesters out, they brought her right back in and sat her in a chair. So I'm not sure what the big emergency was, but then that's when the sergeant said, oh, McGuff and Nguyen, they weren't even in the room when this happened. And then you saw the plainclothes detective who was shielding from view, looking at Ms. Williamson as they're dragging her, and he's sidestepping, going along like this, blocking all the cameras from videotaping what's going on. He tells Ms. Williamson, hey, look, I didn't see what happened. I'm sorry. I had my back. I had my back to what was going on because I was trying to shield this crazy crowd from attacking us. So the question is, why were the other officers lying about it? And the answer is because they know that what they were doing was against policy. It was unlawful. And again, that's my first argument. Now, we don't even get to qualified immunity. We don't even get to the excessive force, or excuse me, I take that back. We don't get to qualified immunity because of what these officers did. I mean, I think by its terms, knowingly violating the law and being incompetent is a subjective inquiry. And we need to look on a subjective inquiry about what the officers did and what they wrote about what they did to try to get into their minds. And I think in this case, qualified immunity does not protect them. I'm conscious that I'm running out of time, but I will say that in Emmons versus Escondido, the Supreme Court per curiam said that what the Court of Appeals, quote, the Court of Appeals should have asked whether a clearly established law prohibited the officers from stopping and taking down a man in these circumstances. And I think that that's what we need to do in this case. We need to take a look at the cases I've cited and to determine whether clearly established law prohibited the officers from doing this. And it does under the non-trivial force doctrine, and it does under the unnecessary causing of pain. Now, I should also say unnecessary causing of pain. I just cited to you the cases just related to handcuffing someone and jerking the hands up. There's many, but I mean, there's even a body of case law with regard to jerking the hands up. And with that, I'll submit.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Roystocker, I'm back to you intentionally now for your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I'm limited in time, so a couple quick points. You know, the district court said this, defendants Nguyen and Magoo dragged plaintiff backwards by the arms from the podium to the exit door. Plaintiff wishes it was solely by the wrist, but it simply wasn't. That's the factual record. Treating somebody different doesn't mean the way you treated them constitutes excessive force.
And no, but it does suggest that there was a readily available, less intrusive to the body alternative, which you had said earlier, well, that isn't necessarily required, but it may inform what a jury could conclude.
Well, I would say this. If you look at the video, they try to lift her up under her armpits in the way they carried the other protesters out, and she fell down. They couldn't hold her. Ms. Williamson was 240 pounds wearing a bulletproof vest and a bulky sweatshirt. She was different in size than some of the other protesters. And that, you know, that sort of goes on to the issue that Judge Callahan raised about passive resistance. To me, passive resistance is somewhat of a misnomer because you are using your body weight to resist the officer's efforts to get you under control. You know, and that's what happened in this case. They tried to pick her up by her armpits. She went dead weight, and they simply couldn't hold her, and she went back down to the ground. And then they rolled her over and removed her in the way that they did. I want to ask you one other question,
and that has to do with the question about using warnings to people, which was discussed in Rice, that the availability of less intrusive alternatives is discussed, and whether proper warnings were given. Is there anything in your view in the record that says that at the time they, in your view, determined that they could not lift her the way they lifted others, that she was warned that if she didn't cooperate, they were going to drag her by the wrists or arms with her handcuffed arms?
There's certainly a lot of evidence in the record that they were all warned several times that they would be removed.
That they were going to be arrested, that's not my question. When they found they couldn't lift her up comfortably, did they warn her that if she didn't cooperate, they were going to use a means that might harm her?
No, there's nothing in the record that says at that exact point in time they said, this is how we're going to remove you. But I go back to what Judge Forrest said, is case law is clearly in the Ninth Circuit that you don't have to use the least intrusive means of force. And I don't think that simply because something came was caused and an injury occurred, as a matter of law, if the option is within the range of reasonable conduct, the fact that an injury is sustained doesn't make it a question for the jury to determine whether there was excessive force. I am somewhat, the plaintiff to me, my colleague seems to be advancing the position that the force used here is something equivalent to non-trivial force. And it's just not. It is nowhere near the force used.
Who decides that? Are you saying that's a matter of law, or is that a matter of fact? Because pulling someone back by their arms can be quite painful to almost everyone. So who decides whether it's non-trivial? Are you saying it's a matter of law?
Yeah, I think that the level of force used is a matter of law. I think this court has always taken force and classified it in one way or the other. Not always consistently. There's minimal, everyone knows what deadly or lethal force is, but then there's intermediate force or significant force. Then there's minimal force. So there are different levels, and I think it's a matter of law what a particular type of force, what category that fits in. Otherwise, you're going to have wildly different interpretations on what type of force constitutes what level. And I think that really feeds into the lack of a established body of law, clearly showing that what the officers did here was unconstitutional.
Thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time by quite a bit. Mm-hmm. The case just argued is submitted, and we thank both of you for very helpful arguments in this challenging case. And with that, we are adjourned for this morning's session.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This court for the session stands adjourned.
I have one question. Do we need to, the cases yesterday, put those on the record as submitted?
I don't think we have to.
Okay, that's fine.
I didn't do that with Monday, so.
Okay, that's fine.